Welcome, everybody. This is Tuesday Morning Ryan, episode number 49. Today we have Ryan Dennehy with us. Ryan is the CEO of Electric, has been a founder of three companies with three exits, knows a lot about scaling businesses and building excellent brands. Ryan, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Man, you guys have been doing great work over at Electric, and you have a crazy career with three exits, which is that's three wins. That's pretty good. How did you, I saw that you started your career as an entrepreneur. So can you talk about that? Like just the elevator speech of your entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah. I just never wanted to work for anybody. That's the thing. And I was a terrible student. So the irony of the whole thing was, I think in the eyes of my teachers or even my peers when I was in school, I was probably the least likely to succeed. Because I didn't really show much promise when I would show up to school every day, but I just felt like, and this is probably setting a terrible example for young people, I just felt like most of what I was being told to learn was kind of a waste of time. And like, that's a naive thing for like a, you know, 15, 16 year old to think, but I just was like, you know what? I think I'm smart. I think I'm hardworking. Like, I just want to do what I want to do. And I think I can find a way to make that work. So yeah, I was really into extreme sports when I was younger, skiing, surfing, mountain biking, skateboarding. And so what I ended up doing, my first business, I was shooting mountain biking videos. And so this was in the time before YouTube. And so if you were an extreme sports video producer, you made DVDs and then you would sell your DVDs in stores. In my case, sell them in bike shops. And so, yeah, the first business, I wrote a sponsorship proposal. Sent it to pretty much every bike company I could find that had a marketing budget. I got a few companies to give me some money to basically travel around and shoot a movie. And then I convinced a bicycle accessories manufacturer in Utah called Lizard Skins, convinced them to add my movie to their catalog. And then they got it sold through their network of dealers in the US. And so I was 17 when all this happened. And so, yeah, it was great. Like, it was a great first business. I mean, I was traveling the world, making decent money. And then, I got an opportunity. I got hit up by a guy named Rudd Davis. This was back in end of my freshman year of college. And he was out in LA. He was raising some money to build an online video network for extreme sports videos. And so, yeah, one thing led to another. He and I hit it off. I could kind of see the writing on the wall with DVDs. And I was like, I think this is all going to be on the internet at some point. And so like that to me was way more exciting than just like shooting videos and trying to sell them in stores. So my first sort of like exit, if you could call it that, was I sold Rudd the assets of my video production company and then joined up with him to basically run this online video network. And then I know we don't have a lot of time today. I'll gloss over the details of how that business nearly died, but we pivoted it to be an online advertising network. So we sold ads on behalf of a large network of other people's extreme sports websites. That business got acquired by USA Today Sports, in my junior year of college. And so we sold that business on New Year's Day, 2008, which was crazy because our investors at the time were like, don't sell now. Like the market's amazing. should raise more money. We're not that smart. We didn't know that there was a housing crisis and an economic collapse looming, but, they always say it's better to be lucky than good. So we exited that business, you know, probably 4 or 5 months before the economy just went totally sideways. So that was that. Spent about 4 years selling ads on the internet, at USA Today Sports, which was fun, but then I did realize I didn't want to spend the rest of my career selling squares and rectangles on web pages. So Rudd and I left, moved to San Francisco, started our first software company. And that was, it was a business doing analytics for brick and mortar retailers. So we could basically tell, you know, we could tell the local bike shop or a clothing boutique or any kind of independent physical retail store when they were busy, when they were slow, what's selling, what wasn't selling. Got that business to a few million in revenue, sold it to Groupon in 2014. And then, 2016, moved back to New York and started Electric. So I'll stop there, but that's what I've been up to essentially for the last 15 years of my life.
I love the craftiness of entrepreneurs because like I'm envisioning a 17 year old Ryan that's like hitting up the bike shops and doing sales. And I feel like most people in general don't take the initiative or just don't think to go try to sell stuff, like make a product and sell it. Where did that come from? Like, where did you get that from?
I don't come from a this doesn't run in my family, for the most part. Right. So, you know, there was nobody who was like pushing me to do this. In fact, it was the opposite. You know, I remember my mom telling me like, if you don't get a job this summer, I'm going to drive you around town and you're going to go like fill out job applications at Kinko's. And I would like, in my head, I was like, that sounds like a nightmare. I'm not like, I'm going to do whatever I can to not have to do that. And so, yeah, when I started the film product, the biggest turning point for me was in high school. One night I was laying in bed. I couldn't sleep. I had a bunch of ideas. And I remember like it was yesterday. It must've been 3 a.m. I've been up all night thinking with just ideas going through my head. And all of a sudden it clicked. I'm like, because I was at the time I was trying to shoot for other production companies. So it's like cold emailing the biggest ski movie production companies and mountain bike production companies and all these skateboard companies that were shooting. They're just trying to get my foot in the door and not having a ton of success. And so like that night, I remember thinking, wait, why can't I write a sponsorship proposal and send it to all these companies? Why can't I reach out to the athletes directly? Why can't I just buy a little bit more video equipment, like, and produce my own film? And like in that moment, I realized like I can do all of like me being at the time 16, 17 years old, like that's completely irrelevant. Like there's no difference between me at whatever age I was then and like someone who'd been doing it a long time fundamentally. Right. So like I woke up the next morning and I'm like, I'm just going to do it. Like I'm going to reach out to the athletes. I'm going to reach out to the sponsors. I'm going to reach out to the distribution companies. And so, yeah, the funny thing though, to kind of bring it full circle to your point about sales is like, I kind of realized, okay, if I can't get distribution for the film, like it doesn't really matter. Like anyone can make a product, but like if you can't sell it, then you don't have a business. And so I cold emailed this ski movie producer named Josh Berman, and he was making really good movies. They were self-produced, but he was selling a lot of copies of these things. And I emailed him and I told him what I was doing. I was like, do you have any tips for me? And we got on the phone and he was like, look, if you can't get a distributor to sell the movie for you, he's like, you can do what my brother and I did, which was for our first two movies, we picked up the phone and we called every ski shop in America. He's like, and we got 1,000 shops to carry the movie. And like, there we go. And all of a sudden everyone started seeing it everywhere. And then it snowballed from there. And so I went to my parents and I was like, hey, look, if I can't get a distributor for this movie, we are going to move some stuff out of the garage. We'll set up some desks and my friends and I will cold call every bike shop in America. And like, if you guys can spot me, whatever, like a couple grand to replicate the DVDs and store them in the garage, then like, I'm all good. They probably thought I was crazy, but I just knew. I'm like if I call enough bike shops, like I can sell enough copies of this thing. Anyways, it didn't come to that. You know, I ended up getting this distributor and they're out in Utah. They hired some kids from BYU and they cold called every shop in America for me. But like, and we sold like, I think 5,000 units.
Yeah.
So it worked.
There's kind of like this, this blend of willingness to risk take, but also like some uncanny ability to identify a market that I noticed a lot of good entrepreneurs have, because you gotta have some self efficacy. You gotta believe in yourself. Like you said, you thought to yourself, self, I can sell this. I can do this. I think most people can't take that leap. So you gotta be willing to believe in yourself, take the risk. But clearly, you understood there was a market too. And I look at that with electric too, because if I think about like providing IT services, so for folks who don't know, electric provides IT services to tech companies and all sorts of companies, but that at the surface of it in 2015, before electric started, there's 1,000 IT service providers, but obviously you identified an opportunity and said, look, we can flip this industry on its head and do something a little bit different. So what made you think that there was something to disrupt in a pretty established marketplace?
Well, I'll tell you what happened before that was my, you know, with my, with my first venture-backed tech company with the online ad network, you know, we were probably the 200th company to enter that space. And it was kind of hopeless because we didn't have anything to differentiate ourselves. And every time we thought we had a new, better version of the model, we'd find that there was either something totally flawed with that thinking, and it wasn't as good of an idea as we thought, or we learned that it was really good. It's just that instead of 200 other people doing it, there were still like 20 other people doing it. And so it actually wasn't that novel. So for the longest time, I just like went through these periods of like, I wouldn't call it depression, but just like discouragement as an entrepreneur, where I felt like all the good ideas were taken. Any gaps in the market that I could exploit, there was either a fatal flaw with the idea, or if it was good, there was already a lot of other people doing it. Electric was the first one where I finally hit the nail on the head with, you know, identifying a need, defining a solution, and realizing that I had done that before anyone else, but not so soon that I was too far ahead of the market. And so really what happened was, when I was running my last company in San Francisco, we were about, I don't know, 30, 40 employees. And so like all the usual IT stuff you have to deal with if you don't have an IT department, we were dealing with, and typically it fell kind of to my feet to resolve. And so like memorable things that were a huge pain in the ass, be like spending all weekend provisioning, like yep. setting up new computers for like new hires. It's like, of all the things I could have been doing on a weekend as a founder of a company, like that didn't seem like a great use of time. Not to mention they were never set up correctly, so everybody would complain, right? Or, you know, our sales team having to get sent home 2 afternoons in a row because our voice over IP phones were down and we couldn't like get anybody on the phone to figure it out. It's like real problems, but in my eyes, I'm like, these aren't like unsolvable problems, like quite the opposite. It's just that the service delivery mechanism for like how IT was solved for SMBs to me didn't seem like it had modernized with the rest of the industry. And so the comparison I often draw is, at the time we were an early customer of Zenefits for our benefits and payroll. So I remember looking at that and being like, wait a second, like we got our whole company up and running on new benefits and a new payroll system in an afternoon without much help, using this piece of software that just hooked into these other systems. And so I remember looking at that and going like, okay, well, so for IT, like it's really not any different. In fact, it should be easier because it's a way less regulated space. Like I'm not dealing with healthcare. I'm just like resetting someone's G Suite password. Like it's not, if you can do it for HR, you can definitely do it for IT. If you can do it for finance, you can definitely do it for IT. But historically what had happened was, almost all of the venture capital dollars in the IT service management space were going toward enterprise solutions. People only wanted to build IT solutions for IT departments. And so here I was back in like 2013, still running my previous company, being like, wait a second, my business is one of millions in the US that are large enough to have an IT budget, but too small to warrant an IT department. No one's built anything for us. And so the reality is, I think it took me 10 years of launching companies based on really mediocre ideas and like having a lot of battle scars from, you know, from that, to get to a place where finally 10 years in as an entrepreneur who had some success, I could finally recognize a great opportunity when it was in front of me. Even then it was still really scary, but at least I was able to understand how big of an opportunity it was, that it was there and that I needed to go do it.
Yeah. Did you start Electric as a VC backed, or did y'all bootstrap for a while? How did you kind of launch the company?
Yeah. Well, so it was VC backed from the beginning, but the crazy part was, with my first two companies, my co-founder had been the CEO of both of those companies and he had handled all the financing. So even though I had built two companies that were VC backed, both had successful exits to public companies, I didn't really personally know any VCs, and I definitely didn't know any in New York. I moved back to New York in 2016. And so as luck would have it, and it's just crazy that it worked out this way, the only venture capitalist I knew in New York City just so happened to be this guy, Mike Brown, whose firm specialized in seed stage investing for B2B software companies. And he specifically, for a long time, had a view on managed IT support and the channel. And all the different ways that that could kind of be reinvented. So I don't know. I mean, again, just kind of going back to being like better to be lucky than good. Like literally the only guy I knew just happened to check all the boxes, and he and I had a good relationship. He had actually, we had talked briefly about, they had a company they were trying to incubate, and we had talked briefly about me stepping in to help run that one. But I kind of came to the conclusion that wasn't a great idea. So when I came back to him with the initial idea for Electric, like he got it right away. And so I was really fortunate. I think based on my track record and in my relationship with Mike, that I was able to raise $2 million before we really had a product or a full team or any revenue, which I acknowledge for most entrepreneurs is generally not something that they're able to do. So, but again, you know, I'd built two companies before this, and I think done a lot of sort of my dues paying up until that.
He was betting on the team and the idea, obviously, at that point. How long did it take you? Like, obviously you get some funding, you have a good idea, you start to build a team. And I think I heard you mention before y'all have like 700 customers or something like that in 5 years, some really large number.
Yeah.
How quick was it that you realized, okay, this is going to work? Like we're getting customers signing up pretty quick.
Well, so here's the thing. I mean, sales is always a slog. Even to this day, like we have a great sales team, and we signed 120 new customers last quarter.
Wow, that's awesome.
Booked like $5.6 million in new, you know, annual recurring revenue just last quarter. But it's like for every single one of those sales reps, like those deals are, they got to fight hard, right? Like it doesn't, I think when you see the revenue going like this, there's a misconception that just the deals are just coming in, and it's a street fight always. Yeah. You just happen to do it at a larger scale. But I'll tell you the moment where I realized the business would work was December of 2016. We had signed up four companies to basically be these pilot customers, and we had convinced them either to stop working with their existing IT provider or to go with us instead of beginning their work with a new IT provider. Handful of companies in New York City. And my hunch was that if we made IT support available through Slack, and we responded in under 10 minutes, and we sent a weekly kind of dashboard type reporting to the main IT decision maker at that company, and had great sort of customer, just sort of really good customer support, customer success to go with it. And if we did all that, it would feel like a 10x better solution than the local IT provider. You're not waiting around 4 or 5 hours to get a call back. You don't even have to pick up the phone. It's not a black box. You know exactly, you know, what are the issues, what, you know, where are all my devices, all this stuff, right? Yep. Really simplify it, modernize it. That was the hunch. But I was really nervous. You know, the 2 million that we raised initially, we did it in two closes. So I closed on the first million, and then I basically had 6 weeks to go find the other million. When the first million hit the bank account, I sat on my couch, and I for one evening, I contemplated giving the money back. Like I was thinking about, I was like, is it too late to give the money back? Because immediately I was thinking of all the ways it wouldn't work. I was thinking of all the ways that like, man, there's already a bunch of companies doing stuff that's similar. There weren't, but I was just kind of psyching myself up. Thank God I didn't give the money back. I just said, no, you know what? Like, we're just going to go for it. And, you know, I have enough conviction in this. And so, yeah, we closed on the second million. We rounded up these first, you know, four customers. And the moment I realized that it worked was when we went live with these first two customers. And within the first day of telling all of the end users, I think we had about 100 end users we were supporting, all of a sudden messages just start coming into Slack. And Julian, our first support desk hire, who's still with the company today, he's intercepting all the chat. We hadn't built any automation yet. We hadn't written any software yet. We were just trying to prove, like, does a modern IT interface, is it something that people are going to really want? All these chats start coming in. He's solving everything, logging everything in our ticketing system. The reports go out, and we come in the next day, and the same thing happens. The next day, the same thing happens, right? And like with my first two companies, I don't think we ever really had that kind of product market fit. Like we were, every day was always like a slog to try to get people to use the product and to try to get everything to work. So here I am, you know, in the first week of being live with our first customers at Electric, and the tickets are just coming in, right? And like, I got a call from Kevin O'Neill, who is our, who is at the time was the head of product engineering at this company, Rocket Trip, which was one of our first customers. And he calls me after the end of the first week and he's like, hey, our engineers usually hate anything involving IT. And like one of the guys just came up to me and said, this was literally like magic. Like you identified a problem on his computer before he knew about it. Like, keep it up.
Yeah.
Now, you know, and so I think that was one of those things where I look back on that first week and it was the most exhilarating thing because for the first time across three companies, I actually had something where like undeniably I could see like people want this and the demand for it is just coming in without me having to go force it into existence.
Yeah, we kind of do something similar on the security front. So we have virtual CISO services and then we also do audits and everyone hates getting audited. We get audited too, but you can make, there's some things you can do to make it a lot less painful. For example, we did the same thing. We kind of have a Slack integration where people can talk, like communicate how they want to communicate. It doesn't have to be this formal email chain. We have a platform that we built so you can exchange stuff and automate stuff. And the same thing though, it's like, I had the same hunch you had when we were building it that, hey, we can make this legacy monolithic process that the big four accounting firms have owned forever just a little bit easier, security a little bit easier. And we got tons of good feedback too. And it was just really changing how folks communicate and kind of receiving that information.
Yeah, I mean, and like, it's kind of a cliche comparison, but if you think about it, like from a user experience standpoint, like something like Uber or Lyft, like really all it is they just took a taxi dispatch service, right? And just took it from a phone into an app and allowed you to see like where the thing was, right? Like, so on paper, if someone explained that to you, you'd be like, I don't know, like what's wrong with just like calling the cab company and having the cab show up?
Yep.
Right. But changing the medium and changing, you know, how the end user experiences the product can have this disproportionate effect on, you know, the way they value the service, on how much they enjoy or don't enjoy using it. So yeah, I mean, it sounds like everything you're doing, it's the same kind of thing. It's just like, how do I make it easier to consume? How do I make this less of a pain in the ass?
Yeah, for sure. So I know, so you grew up, I mean, y'all have been growing like crazy. How many employees, like 400 or something? Is
a ton. Yeah, about 400.
About 400 employees.
Yeah, so, it changes every week, but yeah.
Yeah. How do you spend your time? Cause I imagine like we're 40 person company. I know how I spend my time, but if I imagined us growing 10X, it's like that's just a different dynamic because you lose span of control. Like just tons of different things. So what takes up most of your day?
The biggest change in how I spend my time occurred in 2019. So we were trying to think in 2019, we were like mid single digit millions in revenue, but we were growing fast. So I think we ended 2019 around 8.5 million in revenue, but we were up from like 2.8.
Yeah.
Beginning of the year and a million before that. And we'd gone like 2.8 to 8, but with the plan to go from 8 to 17 or 8 to 18 the next year. So when you're growing that quickly, like most of the work you're doing isn't for the business today. It's how do I basically throw the, you know, lay down the track so the train can just keep going. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the biggest change in my time spent happened in 2019, because it finally occurred to me that like my job wasn't to actually do stuff. Like it wasn't to run any individual department, that it's really on me to hire the best executive team that I can and to really make sure that that team works really well with one another and that they're all really clear on the goals, that I'm doing my part to guide them to the strategies and the objectives that myself and the board think are important, obviously with you know, their input in mind. And that unto itself is a full-time job.
Yep.
And you know, ultimately at any given time, there's always going to be some fire burning somewhere in the business that needs a bunch of your attention. At any given time, for a venture-backed company, you're either preparing to raise money or are raising money. And if you're not doing that, you're likely trying to recruit one or several new executives. You know, and so by the end of 2019, I had essentially recruited a full executive team, a full, you know, senior leadership team. So most of my day in 2019 was really actually spent building that team. You know, one of the things my executive coach told me at the time is he's like, you've got to be okay letting certain fires burn in service of things that are going to deliver a lot more leverage for you over time. Because what had happened before I started working with him was I always let recruiting fall by the wayside, which is like, if you're running a business, is the most short-sighted thing on the planet to do. Because if you don't do it, you'll never actually buy yourself any more time or leverage or skills. You just end up on this treadmill where the more and more you put off recruiting to get the people to do the work you're currently doing, the more of that work you have to take on and the less time you have to recruit.
Yep.
And so, but when you're growing a business quickly, it's like, shit, if I don't respond to this customer, if I don't sit in on this one-on-one with this team member, if I don't do this, whatever the thing is, there's always a good reason. It always seems like, hey, there's going to be some real problems if I don't do that. But like, actually, sure, there are. But the biggest problem is that you don't actually hire anybody to do it and you find yourself in an even worse place in 6 months. And so it took me a long time to really understand that. But then once I did, I was like, all right, so some fires are going to burn and I'm just like, I'm going to be okay. I'm not going to sink the ship, but like, there's just going to be some stuff that doesn't get done. And I'm going to be really clear with my team about that. So, you know, we hired a chief customer officer, VP of product, VP of engineering, CFO, a CMO, all those yep. within 6 months of one another. But then what ended up happening was like, I went into 2020 and for the first time ever was like, wait, everyone's here. Like the gang's all here and I'm not having to sit in on all these meetings to opine on stuff that I'm not an expert on in the first place. I've got great people who can do that.
Yeah. I think Y Combinator wrote an article. It's like things a CEO entrepreneur can't delegate. And I think number one on that list was hiring executives. So that makes sense. That's kind of
where. Oh my God. Yeah. Cause it's like, if you think about it, like the job of a CEO, whether you're running a, you know, I mean, there's like, if you're running a really small business, you kind of have to be doing everything, but as the business scales to a degree where you've actually got some operating leverage, you've got some revenue, you can redeploy into hiring. If you've got real scaling ambitions, you know, the job of a CEO, I think, has more in common with like being like a coach of a sports team, right? Like the best coaches, whether it's in college football and the NBA, they're always thinking about who are the best players I can go get on the team. Who's on the team that, you know, maybe needs a little extra help? Who's on the team that maybe shouldn't be on the team anymore? Mm-hmm. That's what the, you know, like that's essentially what the best coaches are always thinking about is like, who am I missing and how do I get more out of the people that I have? And that's just a total shift in thinking for most entrepreneurs who start their journey by essentially doing all the jobs themselves. Like we were laughing the other day because we had our fifth anniversary as a company and all these photos of me in 2017, like, you know, setting up Wi-Fi routers and like running Cat5 yep. cables with our customers. Or like, I woke up at 4 a.m. to go set up a VoIP phone system at some PR firm back in like the beginning of 2017, right? And it's like, as an entrepreneur, like that's, you're hardwired to have that kind of bias for action. So then like when you start to scale and you have to flip that on its head and you're like, actually the last thing on earth I should be doing is that stuff unless it's a total emergency. It's such a trip to have to completely change your mindset and reprioritize.
Yeah. I think we're kind of at the stage you guys were in 2019 in terms of like growth trajectory and headcount and stuff. So I'm at this weird place where I still have this strong inclination to go do stuff, but I know my best time spent is like motivating people, culture, hiring great people, that kind of thing. So I'm dealing with that exact same thing now. And I think I'm starting to have that same epiphany where it's like, okay, you got to back off. You got to get the right people in the right seats and scale a business here. But that's a fun place to be.
It is. But you know, part of it too is also deciding what you want, right? Like there's not every business should take venture money.
Yep.
Like most businesses probably shouldn't. Not every business and not every founder wants to go take over a whole industry. And that's fine too. You know, I talk to business owners all the time that carve out a little market for themselves in a specific geography or in, you know, a specific vertical and they're really happy and it grows modestly. That's great. If that's what you want. But if you want to, you know, but if your ambition is to, hey, I want to take over a whole market. I want to go big. I want to, you know, swing for the fences. so much of it, like how you spend your time actually has to be calibrated to whatever your ambitions are, sure. You know? And so it's like, yeah, if the plan is to double or triple or whatever, right? And then it's like, oh, well, the highest leverage thing I can probably be doing is figuring out where's the money going to come from to go do that? And where are the people who I'm going to give that money to, where are they going to come from to go execute on that?
What made you choose that adventure? Because, I mean, it sounds like your first two were, well, I guess at least your first one was bootstrapped and your second one was not as big as Electric, it doesn't sound like. And now you're on this scaling adventure. Was that kind of a conscious choice to like try to take over a market and choose this path rather than bootstrapping
it? Yeah. I mean, look, I looked at a lot of different ways of approaching this. I also like, you know, I think after I left Groupon, after the acquisition, you know, I also toyed with some lifestyle businesses that I thought were interesting. Like I also wasn't sure, like, do I really want to go for another long haul and really go, you know, go for a grand slam again. Mm-hmm. But then once I spent more time looking at the idea for Electric, I was like, geez, when am I ever going to find an opportunity this big with this kind of product market fit where I'm not too late, I'm not too early, I don't have any direct competitors, the fundraising, like you sort of went down the list and it was just like, check, 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 like all green lights. Like this is, if there's ever a time to just send it, completely. Yeah. Like it's right now because this has all the ingredients and like I have plenty of time the rest of my life to, you know, take it slower on maybe some smaller ideas or passion projects. But, you know, but I also, you know, I have friends who, you know, who will hit me up for advice. They're working on companies they're trying to start. And like, I had a call the other day with someone I know and he's getting a really interesting business off the ground. But I was like, look, dude, this is a services company, not a tech company. So you really don't want to be raising venture capital money for it. And if you're not going to raise VC dollars, like don't go try to raise a ton of money and like maybe approach it through sort of, you know, focusing on cash flow and profitability. And, you know, it's just, there's no one size fits all. But sure. Again, to answer your question, it's like, well, all the ingredients were here that this was the one I just needed to, I needed to go as big as possible with.
You know, the other thing, like where our businesses overlap, and you're thinking about market size is information security or cybersecurity. And when I look at that, like I read a paper the other day and it said that cyber crime is going to be a $10 trillion criminal industry by 2025, which is set to outpace the criminal drug industry. There's some research saying security assessments market size is going to go from like 2.4 to 10 billion. The platform side's already at like 30 billion. So these are like just huge market forces. And I know that from an IT perspective, like people are using you guys because they want to secure their endpoints, for example. They're using us because they want security roadmaps.
Right.
Like how have you seen that change over the last few years?
Well, I'll tell you what's crazy. Like 5 years ago, I couldn't get a lot of CEOs to care about IT or information security. I mean, fortunately, the market was big enough. I could always find someone who cared about it. Great. It's been in the last 24 months, and you've probably seen the same thing, that it's completely changed because I know the frequency of breaches and the diversity of companies they're hitting. You know, it's not just like, oh, hey, you know, once or twice a year, like Coca-Cola gets hacked or JP Morgan gets hacked. It's like, companies up and down Main Street are getting hacked left and right. People's personal emails and personal information is getting compromised left and right. Just the volume of compromises across the board, individuals and businesses is through the roof, and it's not slowing down. The types of threats are really changing. So I think the average American, be they a business owner or not, is a lot more in tune with the fact that like, hey, you know, information security and breaches, it's like the weather, right? Like, it's just going to happen. And so the question is like, whether you're ready or not. And yeah, I mean, even just like culturally speaking, like you said, it's like going to outpace the, you know, like the drug trade by, you know, whatever year you said. I mean, listen, I listen to a lot of rap music. And there's a lot more people rapping about stealing credit card numbers than selling drugs.
Yeah. It's definitely in like the mainstream. One of the phenomena I see right now is, like how small the companies that care about security are. Like it used to be, like seems like even 5 years ago, it was like a big company problem. But what's happened because of all of the cybersecurity stuff is that these big companies won't do business with the smaller companies unless they have like a security story to tell. Like even you guys at Electric, I'm sure you guys get folks asking security questions. How are you doing this? How are you doing that?
All the time. Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to have that story to tell.
You're totally right though, right? Because like here's the thing, and this is where, you know, I invest in a lot of companies too. And so like this is advice I sort of give to any CEOs, like, this is the kind of not sexy stuff that you just have to be on top of, because security can't be the reason that you don't go close a big deal with a client. You know, security can't be the reason why, you know, you close a big round of financing, but the next day, you know, yep. you get hacked and someone emails all your customers some really foul stuff, right? Like it's kind of like, if you look at like HR, right? HR is kind of the same thing. It's like, you don't want to be a company that does everything right, but you just like didn't pay your payroll taxes and therefore you owe the state of New York $3 million because you just were asleep at the wheel on that, right? Like there's, you know, security's up there with just this list of things that are now, you know, must have that people just didn't think about before. I mean, look, we have a lot of customers that are in the advertising space in New York, and there's a lot of phenomenal small and mid-sized agencies who can land big clients, right? But the difference now is that, you know, we had a 25 person agency that we were supporting, big client in the liquor business, and they had a server that they kept a lot of the media files on, and they insisted on the password being the name of the firm. And we're looking at that going like, you can't do that. Like, I know the owner of the firm doesn't like to remember long passwords, but like that ship has sailed. Like we got to, you know, and, you know, sure enough, like that server got compromised. It cost a lot of people a lot of money, and all that stuff is totally avoidable. So I think it's also kind of gone from being like special teams, sort of like you either kick the field goal or you don't, to now being more strategic. Like,
yep.
You've got to show good security posture if you're a smaller company trying to go win a big piece of business.
Yeah. I know it's how I ran into Electric is we like security assessments, and a lot of these small businesses, you know, like you said, they're trying to find product market fit. They're trying to sell. They're trying to go get revenue. But in the background, the things that have to happen is you have to deploy laptops. And guess what? You have to secure those laptops at every startup. You have to provision G Suite. You have to provision Slack. And by the way, if you're going to get audited, because you have to go through a security certification, you have to have documentation that all that happened. And that's how we ran into Electric, because they were using you guys to do all that stuff and document it. And that's when I realized, okay, like this is, I think it was like a 25 person company that we were doing a security certification for, because they had to do it to do business with like Microsoft or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's where all this stuff comes together, because it's like, that's not the sexy stuff. No one wants to go through a security audit. No one wants to do all of their IT, but you have to. And that's just where we're at as a kind of marketplace and where we overlap, I think.
Oh, big time. Yeah. And honestly, you know, what I would also say is like for anyone who's listening to you and I talk right now and hasn't started their own company, but wants to, like, that's where all the money gets made, is in the stuff that's not glamorous. Like,
yeah.
I find that the less glamorous a business is, the more exciting it is to me. They say one man's trash is another man's treasure. It's like when companies come to us and they're like ripping their hair out and they're like, I had to like spend all this time setting up these computers or messing around their network. I'm like, I love that. I am so happy that you've come to us, because that is all we do. You know, I remember, you know, when I was a little kid, we were in the parking lot at this golf course, and there was this really nice car. I don't remember what it was. And I asked my dad, I was like, oh, whose car is that? And he explains to me, oh, it's this guy that, you know, owns a forklift rental company. You know, and that always stuck with me. I'm like, you know, as I got older, I'm like, those are the businesses that you want to be in, right? It's like, it's real utilities, you know, for stuff that people really need. So whether it's what I'm doing, whether it's what you're doing, whether it's running forklifts, lawns, like, you know, focusing on stuff that people need, but delivering it in a way where the customer is going to be happier and they're going to be able to buy it and use it and get more out of it more easily with you than anyone else. Always a winning combination.
Excellent. Well, Ryan, I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much for giving us some time. I think those are great parting words of wisdom to all the entrepreneurs out there. If you guys like content like this, you like hearing from entrepreneurs, security professionals, privacy professionals, you can check out Tuesday Morning Grind on any podcast app you listen to podcasts. If you want to look at our faces as we talk, you can check us out on YouTube. Just go to YouTube, look up Risk 360. There's a playlist called Tuesday Morning Grind. You can check us out. If you need IT services, check out Electric. If you need security, you want to build a program, you can check out Risk 360. Ryan, appreciate it again.
Christian, thanks so much.